Opioid overdoses continue to claim thousands of lives in Florida each year. Good afternoon. This is Faith Matters on 89.9 WJCT. I'm Kyle Reese, Senior Pastor of Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church and Deputy Director of One Jacks.
And I'm Nancy Bronner, Executive Director of One Jacks, an institute of the University of North Florida. Faith Matters is WJCT's quarterly program, taking a closer look at today's issues through the lens of faith. In 2016, Duval's rate of opioid-related deaths was twice the national and state average.
What part can communities of faith play in addressing this staggering epidemic? Join our conversation now by calling 549-2937.
Right after today's news.
It's the worst drug epidemic in modern American history. In 2017, 3,245 of our fellow Floridians died from an opioid overdose. Opioid overdoses continue to claim thousands of lives in Florida each year. Good afternoon. This is Faith Matters on 89.9 WJCT. I'm Kyle Reese, Senior Pastor of Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church and Deputy Director of One Jacks.
And I'm Nancy Bronner, Executive Director of One Jacks, an institute of the University of North Florida. Faith Matters is WJCT's quarterly program, taking a closer look at today's issues through the lens of faith. As troubling as the state and national statistics may be, the numbers of opioid-related deaths in Duval County are even more grave. In 2016, Duval's rate of opioid-related deaths was twice the national and state average.
What part can communities of faith play in addressing this staggering epidemic? You can join our conversation by calling 549-2937. We want to hear your views.
Joining us now in the studio to help us understand the current state of this opioid crisis is Bill Gulliford, City Council member and chair of the Special Committee on the Opioid Epidemic for the City of Jacksonville. Glad to have you here, Bill.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And joining us by phone is Christian Thrasher, Senior Director of Substance Use Disorders and Recovery for the Clinton Foundation. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you all.
Chris, thanks so much for being with us. We can throw statistic after statistic to try to talk about the opioid epidemic, but in plain terms, help us understand the severity of this crisis.
Sure. Well, this by far is really the worst public health epidemic that we have ever seen in the U.S. I mean, this is now the leading cause of death for men under the age of 50. It's really killed more people than AIDS, gun violence, or even the Vietnam War. And when I think about drug overdoses, I'm not talking about the 88,000 or so that die from alcohol every year or the 45,000 that die from suicide. But this is 70,000 lives lost every single year. In 2017, it was 70,000. The numbers for 2018 actually haven't come out yet. But to put that in perspective, think about the Jacksonville Jaguars Stadium, which has a seating capacity of 67,164 seats. And think about that packed on a Sunday afternoon. And every single one of those people in the stadium dead within 1 year. And when you break that number down, it's really 200 every day or 8 every hour. And so in the hour that this show will be on the air, we're going to lose another 8 to a drug overdose. But more important than these numbers that I'm throwing at you is the fact that these are moms and dads and brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, husbands and wives. I mean, all of us have a story. And unfortunately, these stories for too many of us will never be told because of substance use disorders. What we know is that we have 20 million people living with a substance use disorder in this country, and roughly only about 10% of them will receive treatment. And that's recognizing that we have a federal law, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, in place, but yet only 10% of them will receive the treatment that they need. What's also worth mentioning here is that in large part, you know, substance use disorders, from a numbers perspective, has stayed relatively the same over the years, but it's the fatalities that are going up every year. And that's because of opioids and fentanyl and carfentanil, and we'll talk about that later. But that's just to give you an idea of how severe this epidemic sure. really is.
Thanks, Chris. I mean, as horrifying as those statistics are nationally, Bill Gulliford, you know about how horrifying it is on a local level. You're the chair of the Special Committee on the Opioid Epidemic for the City of Jacksonville. Localize this for us. How bad is the opioid crisis here in Jacksonville?
Well, we see the sensationalism of homicides in this city. You know, every homicide gets attention in the media. Over the past 3 years, we've had a total of 375 homicide deaths. In that same period of time, we had 1,309 opioid overdose deaths that we know of, because the medical professionals will pretty well tell you that they're guessing that it's considerably higher than that. Another thing that we've run into is this issue of endocarditis, which we're not able to have the statistics that Canada has, or the being able to follow people because of the medical system they have. But there's a statistic out there that says that people that develop endocarditis, which is related to all of this, that there's up to a 20% mortality rate in the first 5 years, and nobody's talking about that. So you don't know what the impact is long term.
Talk about, for those who may not recognize that term, endocarditis.
Endocarditis is an infection of the heart valve or heart tissue, and it's related to continuing opioid use or intravenous drug use. And so it's a issue. We've seen 128 cases a year ago in St. Vincent's, which is where our first Project Save Lives started, their emergency department. And we've seen it drop, because of the drop in repeats, to about 26 okay. cases in the last quarter. So it's an issue too, but we're not talking about it.
Sure.
Chris, on a national level and locally, as illustrated by our conversation today, people are starting to talk about this crisis and beginning to educate themselves on all of the ways that it is playing out in communities around the country. On a national level, not only are there conversations, but we know that there is work being done. Where is the energy of that work? Is it more on addressing the supply, or more work with those on the demand side of the coin?
I think it's really both. I think, you know, from the supply side, you know, we're starting to see some movement, pharmacies working with prescribers, not filling, you know, long-term opioid prescriptions. Things like drug take-back days, where there are two every year. It's always the last Saturday in April and October, where the DEA sponsors nationally a drug take-back day. 50% of all opioids come from medicine cabinets, unused or expired. And so we need to figure out ways of getting them off the streets. Naloxone, another great example of the supply side, the life-saving drug, but it's expensive. We at the Clinton Foundation have been working with the manufacturers of naloxone to get some public interest pricing, make it more affordable, more accessible, because with drugs like fentanyl and carfentanil being 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine, and carfentanil 1,000 times, if you can imagine, stronger than heroin, you can't get very often naloxone there in time. First responders are not getting there in time, and so we as community members have to pick up the slack there and all be carrying naloxone with us. From a demand side, I would say that we really need to work with the person who has an SUD and even their family. I mean, at the community level, we need more resources, right, put into prevention, put into treatment, into recovery, and the healthcare system. Too often, I think, when we see people with a substance use disorder taken in via ambulance into the emergency room, we're great at reviving them, but then we put them out back onto the street, and they go right back to the same, environment that they came from. And what we know about people that are in long-term recovery, there are four factors that determine their ability to experience successful long-term recovery. That is employment, education, housing, and human connection. And so you'll hear a term often used called wraparound services, but what we really need to be focused on is not only saving the life of the person with a substance use disorder, but then also how do we give them the resources that they need so they can get into a job and get into safe and stable housing, get them the education that they might need, and probably, perhaps most importantly, the human connection piece. I mean, when we think about social determinants of health, which is, you know, where we live and where we work and sleep and play, I would even add to that where we worship, all of these factors play a role in someone who has a substance use disorder and how we experience the health.
Sure.
And we all have.
And we want you to be a part of our conversation, 549-2937. We're setting the stage as we try to get our minds around this epidemic and then begin to talk about ways, as Chris just mentioned, that faith communities can and are playing a part in trying to alleviate the suffering and the struggle. But Bill Guilford, Chris said something that...
I had to chuckle a little bit because, Chris, that's exactly what we are doing with Project Save Lives, which in the first emergency room we went into, we've been there 18 months and we've seen some incredible results. We've seen almost 70% drop in repeats into that emergency room. What we do is you illuminated very well the problem of just treating them the way we've been treating them and putting them back on the street. We engage them with a recovery peer specialist who is a professionally trained former addict. And we give them a choice to be in the program. They're either going to be an outpatient or they're going to be in residential treatment. And that recovery peer specialist has contact with them 24 hours a day. He or she are available to them. And we have stopped the dying to a fairly reasonable extent, not all of it. We've lost two people in the time we've been in St. Vincent's emergency room. We're now in three more emergency rooms with the help of God. We'll be in three more before the end of the year. But we're doing exactly what you're alluding to, and that was the big problem that became very obvious. We have a Dr. Ray Palm here who sort of designed that program, and I think we need to make more and more people around the country aware of what he's doing, what we're doing with that program.
We want to hear some more about that locally and nationally. First, let's take a few calls that we're getting. We're going to go to Carmen. Carmen, you're on the air from Mandarin. Go ahead.
Thank you. I think the first thing in dealing with the long-term opioid problem is to first stop selling the idea that life is pain-free. Well, that's where a lot of it starts.
That's a good point, Carmen. Thank you for that. So it's been said that when pain was made one of the vital signs, that created the appetite in our community, in our nation, for doctors to relieve pain. Bill, what do you say about that?
When we had our first community conversation, I had a doctor come up to me afterwards, and he said, you know, we're a lot the cause of this. Because you're right, we started judging, and they were rated and judged based on their ability to take away pain. And that was a horrible thing in retrospect, to open the doors to this whole pain-free existence that we thought we had. So, she's absolutely correct.
Yeah. And we have another call. We're going to talk to Jason. Jason, go ahead with your comment.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
I'm here from Florida, and something I just wanted to pass on to y'all that may, I feel it'll stop the opioid problem. If you have the way that I got my, I'm an ex-opioid addict, all right? What I did is I went to a doctor who was retiring, and he was just looking to make the $150 per visit cash. I was asked two or three questions, are you tolerating your meds well?
And that's how you got it. Well, thank you. Thank you, Jason.
Oh, yes, ma'am. And I was a brain injury survivor. So my way to fix this opioid problem is to provide your doctor's paperwork, your injury report to the doctor and the pharmacist. So whenever you get a sideways doctor that's just going to write you whatever he wants to write you, your pharmacist can at least say, wait a second, you've got a stubbed toe. This doesn't add up here. Or, hey, you actually have a brain injury. Let me fill this prescription.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.
Thank
Jason.
You, Jason. Chris, comment on Jason's thoughts, his question, and what's happening nationally with regulatory work regarding these drugs.
Sure. Well, I will go back to the first caller's comment, which I think she was spot on in saying that we as Americans are not great at dealing with pain, whether that's physical pain, mental pain, emotional, or even spiritual pain, right? And so too often in our country, you know, if one is good, then two must be better. And that even applies to things like Advil. I have a bad headache. I know it says to take two, so that means if I take four, it'll be twice as good. The reality is, we here in the United States make up roughly 5% of the world's total population, but yet we use 80% of all the opioids prescribed. You know, those scales are not balanced. And listen, we're not talking, this last caller, we're not talking about the 28 million people right now who live in our country with legitimate chronic pain. That's a reality. We need to figure out how, because opioids do have a place, right? They do have a place in our society. The question is, how do we help the 28 million people with legitimate chronic pain and also help the people that are addicted to these opioids because, like your caller said, they came in with a sprained ankle or a wisdom tooth that got pulled out, and, you know, 10, 12, 15 days later, they found themselves addicted to opioids.
Yeah, it happens quickly. Bill, let's go back to you. I want to hear about the work of your committee. Tell the listeners about the work, how the committee got formed on the city council, and what your work has been.
Well, we started Project Save Lives in 2017 after that community, a couple of community conversations, and after Dr. Palm and several other medical professionals came up with sort of a design. We figured we couldn't wait for the feds and the state to fund it, so the city council agreed to put up $1.4 million, and we started the pilot program, St. Vincent's Emergency Room. Dr. Gilberstadt, who's the head of the emergency department in St. Vincent's now, is probably one of our most strongest proponents of this program. But we got into St. Vincent's, and it was hard. Getting non-hospital personnel into an emergency room is not an easy thing with all the regulations. So we got in there, and we started, and we grew it to over 300 people in the program at St. Vincent's over 18 months. As I said, we've seen a 70%, almost 70% drop in repeats, which was a lot of the problem. As Chris has said, you know, we kept doing the same thing over and over again. We transport them, we treat them, we put them back on the street. They're probably still withdrawing. Guess what they're going to do?
Yeah.
So this gives them an option. Half the people we approached agreed to participate in the program. What surprised us was we were expecting a lot higher number of those that wanted to go into residential treatment, but that was not the case. The vast number of them have been in outpatient treatment. And I've heard testimony from both the recovery peer specialists, who are the most important cog in this whole thing, and people that are in the program, and it's been pretty miraculous, really, what's happened. And we've now exported it to more emergency rooms. The most recent one is Park West, which is over at 103rd, and, you know, it's sort of the epicenter. If you look at the statistics, it's the really bad area where we've seen continued growth in overdoses, where other areas we've seen some decline. So it has been a miracle. Every week these people meet. Dave Castleman, who's the chief of fire and rescue, a fellow, an assistant chief named Mark Riley, who is outstanding statistically and passionately. Dr. Ray Palm with Gateway Medical Professional. Dr. Gilberstadt, head of the emergency department. We've now set up a trust fund. And the first people that donated without any solicitation to the trust fund were the doctors at St. Vincent's. Mm-hmm. They were so impressed with the program, they made the first contribution.
Fantastic. Let's go back to the phones and talk to Peter on the east side. Peter, go ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, hi. We've discussed how people get on opioids, but we haven't really talked about how they get off in the following sense. To successfully get off opioids or quit cigarette smoking or reduce your weight, you have to want to do it. So I'd be interested in hearing from the experts on the panel at St. Vincent's how they get people to want to quit drugs.
All right. Thank you very much, Peter. Chris, let's go to you. And Peter, the panel is not of St. Vincent's folks. We've got Chris Thrasher from the Clinton Foundation Opioid Project and Bill Gulliford, who's chair of the City Council Special Committee. But we certainly have a lot of experience between these two. So, Chris, can you talk to about Peter's question?
And Chris, as you do that, I think it's a nice segue. His question leads to one of the things that both you and Bill have mentioned is the fact of personal relationship that helps someone get over the addiction. Obviously, there's science and all of the other things, but you talk about that personal relationship and the wraparound service of that. And that's how the Clinton Foundation has come to Jacksonville to talk to faith leaders about how places of worship can facilitate those conversations and relationships.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. You know, I will share with you that I'm a person in long-term recovery myself, and what that means for me is that I have not found it necessary to have a drink or a drug in my body since December 17th, 1989, coming up here on 30 years of continuous abstinence. But, you know, it didn't start out with a lot of desire. I will share with you that it was a nudge from a judge that said, you know, Chris, it's time to make a decision. You know, there was a crossroads that I came to. And when people ask me, you know, well, how did you make the decision? I often talk about that acronym of HOW, standing for honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, right? So I needed to be honest with myself, and certainly with this epidemic. We as a community, we as a society, we as individuals need to be honest with ourselves that this cuts across every demographic. Age, race, sexual identity, socioeconomic status, religion, even lack of religion. So it affects all of us. And open-mindedness was so important to me, recognizing that I didn't have all the answers. And certainly with this opioid epidemic, we're going to need a multi-pronged approach that might start with medically assisted treatment, you know, like the buprenorphines or the naltrexones, to give them a chance, these addicts, a chance to be able to just not experience the brutal withdrawals that are associated with opioids and give them a chance to have some of these other services incorporated into their life. And then finally, willingness. You know, at the end of the day, when I came to the crossroads for myself, I needed to ultimately make a decision. You know, am I willing to do what it takes? My grandma always used to tell me, Chris, God will move mountains for you, but you have to bring the shovel. And so for me, it's about having brought the shovel for the last 29 plus years to do the work on myself that it takes to remain in long-term recovery.
Thank you. We're talking with Chris Thasher and Bill Gulliford. We want to hear your views. 549-2937. Give us a call.
Bill, you talked earlier, and Chris just said something about how the opioid epidemic cuts across all demographics.
Mm-hmm.
And in Jacksonville, with your intimate knowledge of the demographics here, you said earlier that socioeconomic level, none of the normal demographic breakdowns own this crisis.
No, everybody. Not at all. Not at all. In fact, I spoke to the board of the Chamber of Commerce Friday at breakfast, and one of the things I took was a map, a 2018 map, pinpointing the location of every overdose call that came into Jacksonville Fire and Rescue, and it is all over the map. And as one first responder said to me several months back, he said, I have been in everything from oceanfront houses to shacks and everything in between. I think the scary thing about this also is that we tend to be sanctimonious and we stereotype the people as if they really want to do this. They're just doing this to get high. And I think that we need to change that approach because these people are really, it is a disease and it's difficult for us. That goes back to what I said about the recovery peer specialist. Here you've got somebody that's been in your shoes and you can immediately identify with them. And that's been the big success of this program. The head of our peers is a recovered addict, 17 years in recovery, and he has been fantastic. And he coaches and he teaches and he motivates the peers. They're all very dedicated young people. I'm going to take them all to lunch in about a week or so. They're just great mm-hmm. people.
That's great. Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have to do.
Yeah,
Chris, in the Clinton Foundation's work with faith leaders in the community, you talk a lot about the faith community reducing stigma, and that is a major challenge to address this crisis.
Absolutely. I mean, We identified the faith-based community as just being a central place that we really felt like we could take stigma head-on. What we know is that Sunday is still the most segregated day of the week, which really provides both an opportunity and a challenge, right? We also know that more than a third of us as Americans attend religious services weekly. But faith leaders are often really in a long-term relationship with their congregants, and it enables them to detect signs of distress and intervene, but only if they really feel confident and capable to do so. And that's where the Clinton Foundation has stepped in. When we convened this group of faith leaders and we asked them, tried to do a needs assessment to understand what are the issues that they're really experiencing at the community level among their congregants, there was a real hesitation for people to seek help, and they knew that. And so it was important for faith leaders to sort of take the first step, take the initiative, and begin a dialogue whenever possible because of the central role that they play. But what we heard from them is we really lack a language from the pulpit to have these conversations with our congregants. And so we've been helping them to give them the confidence and the tools and the skills and the education that they need to be able to have that conversation, whether it's from the pulpit or in pastoral counseling sessions or just, you know, informally. Faith leaders have this unique ability to help foster change, to shape and inform and influence attitudes that just so often contribute to inequities. I mean, changing the mindset that addiction is not a moral failing, but it is a treatable disease, is just a huge thing that I think faith leaders can do.
And for Chris, let me make a point that you just brought up. When was the last time you saw an obituary that said this individual died of a opioid overdose? Same kind of concern on the part of those that they left behind, that it's a stigma. It's perceived as something, they did something really bad. And I think we've got to get past that. And I think faith leaders certainly are in a great position to do that.
Absolutely. And in the second half of today's program, we're going to talk to a couple of faith leaders who are actively working to alleviate addiction and help respond to the opioid crisis. So we'll hear from them. Councilman Bill Gulliford, thank you so much for what you're doing in our community and for being with us today. And Chris Thrasher, we appreciate your insight, and you're going to stay on the phone with us for the second segment. So appreciate that. You're listening to Faith Matters on 89.9 WJCT. I'm Nancy Bronner, Executive Director of UNF's One Jacks Institute.
And I'm Kyle Reese, Deputy Director of One Jacks and Senior Pastor at Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church. We'll be right back with more Faith Matters. Welcome back to Faith Matters, WJCT's quarterly program exploring today's issues through the lens of faith. I'm Kyle Reese.
And I'm Nancy Bronner. If you're just joining us, we're talking about faith and the opioid crisis.
We are glad to continue our conversation. Chris Thrasher from the Clinton Foundation continues on the phone with us. Thanks for being with us, Chris. And we welcome these into our studio. Shirley Ann Roberts, a retired correctional drug offender, probation and parole senior officer from the state of Florida Department of Corrections. Welcome, Shirley Ann.
Thank you.
And also, we welcome to our conversation Canon Allison DeFore, Canon to the Ordinary of the Episcopal Diocese of Florida.
Howdy.
And you can join our conversation as well by calling 549-2937. What are your thoughts about the role that faith communities can play in addressing the opioid crisis?
Shirley Ann, you are a leader in your church's rehabilitation ministry, and we've had several conversations about that. Tell us about the work you do in your faith community.
Basically, we are into redirect and self-help. We provide self-help groups as needed. We do sponsorship and follow-up care. We explain the truth needed to overcome and to live free in a loving environment. We demonstrate God's love, grace, and forgiveness. And our main reason for doing this is because the people that successfully remain overcomers of this addiction have to submit to a supreme being whom they identify as the Lord Jesus Christ.
Okay, thank you very much. And Allison, you have a remarkable background in politics, law enforcement, and now you're a part of the Episcopal Church. Tell us about your journey and the role the faith community has played in it.
I had a lot to repent. Episcopal Church has a long tradition of involvement in this area. The 12-step movement was, in many respects, kind of birthed out of Sam Shoemaker's church in New York City and his work in Pittsburgh, and the Oxford movement helped birth it. So we were in it from the very, very beginning, and it's been a very powerful movement for us.
Chris Thasher, we have spoken just briefly about the Clinton Foundation coming to Jacksonville, but we are actually the third community that the Clinton Foundation is working in, working with faith leaders. I believe also Houston and Little Rock have this initiative happening. Talk a little bit about the ways that you see faith communities trying to address this epidemic.
Sure. Yeah, our work in Houston really dates back to very early in 2018. When we convened our first group of faith leaders in Houston. At that time, we really called it a faith-based roundtable. We didn't really know what we were getting ourselves into, other than we knew that bringing faith leaders together was critically important in addressing this issue. And at our first meeting, we had an overwhelming response. We had 20 leaders from 12 different faith traditions, truly an interfaith process, come together to discuss the impact that opioids is having on their community. Then several months later, we launched in Little Rock, Arkansas, in the fall, where we had 24 faith leaders representing 9 faith traditions. So once again, really across faith traditions. But our goal with this is really to educate, to motivate, and to mobilize these leaders to address opioids. And ultimately, we hope to inform a national strategy that will result in a replicable model that we then can scale. Because what we really do know is that 1 + 1 + 1 is always far greater than 3, and that partnership and collaboration will be the key to fighting this epidemic. So this idea that we have these faith leaders together in a room, in many cases for the first time working across faith traditions, the power of that has just been quite amazing to watch these leaders come together and have difficult conversations, but at the end of the day, work together to do many, many great things.
And Allison and Shirley Ann, you've both been attending the Clinton meetings that we're having locally with faith leaders. Allison, you were nodding during Chris's comments. Would you follow up with his remarks?
Well, part of my problem with this is I feel like I'm watching a house fire and people are talking a lot about the statistics about what the temperature is of the flame. My life has involved almost everything that there is to be in the justice system. I was a public defender. I was a prosecutor. I was a county and circuit judge, sheriff of my county, on the board of the bar. I was a law professor. I mean, I've seen this thing about every way there is to see it. And there is no law enforcement solution. It does not exist. It cannot exist. This is a medical and social problem. And you can put the fire out, maybe, mm-hmm. with the tools that we've got deployed right now. But ultimately, this is a spiritual problem. And we've got to start deploying spiritual solutions, or we're in very big trouble, as Councilman Guilford indicated in his numbers.
Mm-hmm. And you can join our conversation again by calling 549-2937. So, Allison, follow up a little bit more. Talk about the spiritual solution to this. Describe what you mean.
Well, Carl Jung pointed out in his correspondence with Bill Wilson, the founder of the 12-step movement, that they don't call these things spirits for nothing. I mean, this attempt by all of humankind to get in touch with the spiritual side, we find a lot of vehicles to try and do that. And alcohol, drugs, sex, money, power. Mm-hmm. And we try a lot of things, and maybe they work for a little while, but they don't work for long. Mm-hmm. And when they don't work, that's when we're bankrupt. And at least that was my personal experience in my life and in many other people's lives. And then you end up turning to whatever your understanding of a higher power is, and then that higher power begins to work on you, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Shirley Ann, you talk about the work of your church. Do you find those who are coming and battling with addiction and trying to find a way forward, are they mostly members of your congregation, or is it a community outreach?
It's a community outreach, and about 85% outside of our church.
Wonderful, wonderful.
And we're going to hear from you in the community, and we're talking with Sarah. Sarah, go ahead with your comment. You're on the air.
Hello. There is a population of people I think we are forgetting, and those are individuals who are not addicts, but they are opiate dependent. There is a large group of people who are taking opioids, not because they're addicted, but because they have chronic pain. There has been such a stigma on those who take opioids that they're all addicts, and they're not.
Yeah.
And those people who need that type of medication to deal with their chronic pain. Another comment on that is there has been a lot of times in my life where science and spirituality do not work together. My question to your panel is, how can we combine spirituality and science in order to help all individuals, those who are addicts and those who are dependent? But again, to completely exclude a population of people who are dependent but not addicts, I think is an oversight.
Sure, and thank you for that, Sarah. Chris, I want you to comment again, because you said earlier in the show about those who needed opioids for pain treatment.
Sure. Yeah, we know that there are about 28 million Americans living with legitimate chronic pain. And like I said earlier in the show, we cannot forget about that population. So I appreciate her comments. And I absolutely agree with her. You know, this is a very, very difficult problem to navigate because of that. And so we have our work cut out for us. There's no question about it. But I absolutely appreciate her comment and totally agree with her that many of us have legitimate chronic pain, and opioids do have a place but need to be used responsibly.
Shirley Ann, I remember the first conversation we had after the first gathering, and you talked about that balance of science and 12-step programs along with a faith commitment. And you talked about the relationship between the two, that I remember you saying you believe in the 12-step process.
Yes, I do. And we talk about science. Science is a fact. 1 + 1 = 2. You cannot kick this thing. You cannot give up this addiction unless you submit to a supreme being whom we identify as God. And that's one reason why the courts have developed drug offender probation. My title is correctional probation, drug offender probation officer. We correct and we redirect. Where there is knowledge, there is power. You put them in a loving environment and you tell them that this wasn't the way they were created. And you teach them the steps to commit that I want to change. And with a supreme being who we identify as God, give them that ability to become overcomers. And we at the Bethel Church and our self-help group walk them through those steps with love and support and sponsorship. And I know personally, with 40 years in this, I have seen the success in this when you follow these steps. It's a fact.
Mm-hmm. Allison, talk about the underlying thing that is happening. And I think many faith traditions speak to this. We have to have a theology of pain, that some pain needs to be medicated, but pain is also a part of life. And how can faith communities begin to talk about that and bear one another's burdens through the painful times?
Well, we don't find an antagonism in the Episcopal tradition between science and faith. We believe that they're quite consistent, and that faith is a several thousand year old attempt to explain what are verifiable facts, which is that meditation changes brainwaves. Well, meditation's a lot older than being an MD. I can tell you that by several thousand years. The fact that people who live in community of faith, that makes all the difference in the world. The famous rat experiment where they had the rat that was alone and drugged itself to death. The Canadian researcher who said, well, that's interesting. I wonder what they do in community. And the amazing thing was when you put them in community, you found that they didn't do that, that they, in fact, which was consistent with the experience of addicts coming back from the Vietnam War or heroin users coming back from the Vietnam War. So at the end of the day, a lot of what we see in the faith community is just an attempt to explain in common terms or old terms that which science is now catching up with in much more precise terms. Mm-hmm. And that's really, with regard to a theology, ultimately, pain is a great teacher. And there's a great book out by a fellow named Richard Rohr, who's a Franciscan, and he says that there's very little learning after the age of 30 in success or achievement. It's all in failure mm-hmm. and loss and pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Kyle, you're heavily involved in interfaith work here in Jacksonville. We've heard from a Christian perspective a couple of times, but broaden this for us into all faiths here represented in Jacksonville.
Well, I think one of the things that we see, and I think one of the good things that comes out of a crisis like this is it really creates sort of a all hands on deck, and it gives and we've mentioned here that this cuts across every demographic. So really remarkable conversations. We talk about the power of meditation, mm-hmm. and our friends in the Buddhist community teach us a lot about what that means and how we can find peace and strength in that. We have a wonderful presence from the Jewish community in this work who are marshaling all of their resources. So on the one hand, we say that this crisis cuts across all demographics, but that gives us the opportunity to bring so many people to the table and learn from one another.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and if I can say to that, there's nothing in the 12 steps that I call it spirituality for dummies like me. There's nothing in the 12 steps that doesn't come out of all of the faith traditions. You're basically mm-hmm. looking at surrender to a higher power than yourself, getting out of your own self-awareness, confession, self-awareness, make amends with others, pray and meditate, and then help other people. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty old formula for happiness in all the faith traditions.
Very much so.
That's true. And both of you, Shirley Ann and Allison, have had interaction in the prison systems. Allison, you have been a prison chaplain for many years. Is that right?
I was.
And of course, Shirley Ann, we've talked about your background. What have you all learned from that experience in terms of the way we should be intervening to help people turn their lives around?
You know, something, the amazing thing about this is that just like Kyle said earlier, this is really a blessing in disguise because it really opens up the door to really paint a picture of what the faith community has actually been doing since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Since the beginning, we talk about pain. There are some people that's actually on pain. Those people are not creating this epidemic. It is the one that's addicted to it, too much of a good thing, and has become physically dependent on it. And what the faith community does, even in the prison system, the facility-based, the structured treatment program, even in the church settings, I have actually participated in all those group settings. My probationers that attended the church-based setting, whether it was Jewish, acupuncture, meditation, Baptist, whatever, they were the best groups. They were successful. They recovered. They became overcoming. Just basically submitting to a higher power. Mm-hmm. And church teach you how to submit to their higher power.
Mm-hmm. We want you to be a part of our conversation by calling 549-2937.
And we're can I chime in here just real quick?
Sure, yes, and then we're going to take a call. Go ahead, Chris.
Sure, yeah. I just want to speak from someone in the recovery community because I think many people come into recovery with a lot of baggage around organized religion. And I want to speak to this whole issue of the intersection of science and faith. You know, the reality is that our faith, our deeply held beliefs, shape and inform and influence how we interpret the science. That's just the truth. And so if I'm an atheist, if I'm an agnostic, it's still a deeply held belief. And I don't want to leave those folks out of this conversation because I think it's very important to recognize that, you know, when I came into the program, I had a void. And it took me years to understand that it was actually a God-shaped void. But that's for me. That's my experience. That might not be the next person's experience. And so I think the beautiful part about what 12-step programs are able to do is meet the person where they are at. That's why we use, you know, specifically vague terminology like higher power, because it's not, it doesn't have the same meaning necessarily as the word God. And I appreciate everyone's deeply held beliefs, but I want to, you know, I want to at least make the point that not everyone is on the same spiritual journey, and there is room for every manifestation of the addict in the rooms.
Thank you, Chris. That's an important distinction. And we're going to go to the phones right now, and we're speaking with Linda from Fort Caroline. Linda, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say that I agreed with one of the earlier callers and in the fact that there are people that are on drugs for all the wrong reasons, but I myself have chronic pain issues and have since I was 12 years old, and I'm one of those that need it. But sadly, oftentimes, and what happened to me in the last 5 years since my husband died, I did not get the church support that I needed. One cannot see pain, and therefore, oftentimes, you know, it goes unnoticed. Even though folks may know that you take medicine, they don't realize that oftentimes it's not the medicine that is the problem. It's the fact that they are disconnected from people. They're ignored by people, and you live in a world where nobody really cares because you don't really look sick because pain is not visible. And that about 2.5 years ago led me down a path that a very dangerous path, and thankfully my faith my faith in God allowed me to just one day decide to go elsewhere and look for people who cared in the community and especially in the church,
right?
Because that's where I get my faith the most.
Linda, yeah. Thank you so much for that comment.
And Allison, as you were listening to Linda's comments, you're shaking your head.
Well, isolation is not divine, and that's one thing you learn pretty quick in addiction work. That's why I stress the rat study, because it's got to be done in community to really be successful. In my faith tradition, even the nature of the divine is expressed in the form of the Trinity, which is itself a form of community. It's at the core of my faith tradition. That being said, I'd agree with Chris. Religion is not terribly helpful in this particular context. Religion is too often a means of, pardon me, putting God sort of into a controllable environment and manipulating God, and it can help point you in the right direction towards God, but ultimately you've got to move outside of that and into a much more spiritual and more intimate plane than religion normally permits on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I would like to come in on that. Based on my training that we get, You never walk into a room and say, oh, this is the only way. It's God. What we do is teach them the basic steps, something to believe in, someone to believe in. We become that person. We tell them, you have to submit. What is that void? What are you looking for? We love you. Love is universal. And the people would tell me, a probation looked at me, and the majority of them would say, I don't have any support. I don't have any love. I don't have it. What God would do this to me? I just want to give up. And I would say, what about me? Let's get to know me. Allow me to walk these steps right. with you. I'll go to treatment process with you.
Mm-hmm.
And before it's over with, don't push it. Because if it's really about love, you will submit to that supreme being.
Mm-hmm. Really, the most important thing to learn is that it's not you, that you're not the supreme being, which is what most of us have a hard time learning.
Yeah.
Chris Thrasher, Reverend Erica Pillay from the Harm Reduction Coalition states this, faith leaders need to replace stigma with compassion. How is that done? How is that being done?
I think the principle of listening, you know, listening is absolutely key. Too often we are so quick with our response, our answer, our point of view. But for people with substance use disorders, they need to be listened to. You know, I work with newcomers all the time. Newcomers are someone just coming into recovery. And, you know, one of the best things that I can do is just listen to them, pay attention to them. They've been trying to be heard for years. And so when they finally get into recovery, if you want to replace stigma with compassion, try listening.
And she goes on to say that the task of religious institutions, specifically regarding this epidemic, is to be able to speak to both sides. She states that is giving hope while also understanding science. I think as faith communities, I hope we have the hope part down. But what are some resources to help understand the science of addiction and specifically the opioid epidemic?
Well, I think there are, right now, you know, because there's so much attention being put on opioids. If you literally just go into your computer and Google opioids and faith or opioid documentary, I mean, you're going to be hit with just a ton of resources that are out there and available. I mean, one of the things that's happening right now is that a lot of money is being put into this epidemic, and, a lot of things are coming out as a result. So it's just a matter of, you know, you having willingness to go in and try and find out what resources are out there. Now, I do want to put a plug in for some of the work that we've been doing because it's right in line with this, and that is in each of these communities that we go into, we work with our faith leaders to develop what we call a comprehensive resource guide. And it's really for their communities on local prevention, treatment, and recovery resources specific to their community. And so with each of these communities, look for one coming in Jacksonville very soon. We are going to disseminate it widely, but it will have resources all in those areas, prevention, treatment, and recovery. And
Chris, I'm going to have to break in, and thank you so much. We'll be looking for that. We're out of time.
So Christian Thrasher, Shirley Ann Roberts, Allison DeFore, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Faith Matters. We're committed to bringing you diverse opinions and perspectives on matters of faith, and we'll be returning each quarter with new voices to add to these conversations.
This show's producer is Jessica Palumbo. If you missed any of today's program, you can find the podcast later today at wjctnews.org. I'm Kyle Reese, Senior Pastor of Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church and Deputy Director of One Jacks.
And I'm Nancy Bronner, Executive Director of One Jacks. This has been Faith Matters. All Things Considered is coming up next. Thanks for listening.